I need to be there more often, because of course back in the day I would always just go to Berlin all the time, right? As the classic thing. And then I, what was the reason? Maybe some event was going on, and I was hosting it or something. I visited Munich and I spent an extra 2 days, just to tour around. And I was like, wow, this place is amazing. You know, really, yeah, beautiful place. Anyway, we're live, folks. So welcome everybody to Founders Focus episode 2. This is our new series where we're talking to the leaders and CEOs and founders of the HR technology businesses that are changing the way in which we work. And this is our opportunity, I guess, to get to know these products and companies a little bit better through getting up close and personal with the CEO of that business. Because I think the personality of the leader really does have an impact, not only on the business, but also on the product and service they provide to all of us in the community as well. So excited to bring episode 2 with you today. I'm with Hanno Renner, CEO of Presonio. So Hanno, welcome to the show.
Hi, Hong. Great to be here. And hi, everyone.
It's great to have you. Let's just kick this off. I mean, what important thing did you have to cancel in order to appear on Founders Focus, Hanno?
Well, I guess I would have to ask Dominique what she moved around. She keeps making things possible in my calendar. She's my assistant and owns everything I do throughout the week. So I'm sure there was things she had to shuffle around to make space. But overall, I think.
So you don't even know, Hanno, what the important thing is. It's like it could be something critically important, like presentation to somebody. You think, oh my goodness, I've shifted it later on down the day. But listen, it's a real honor to have you with us, because you know, I've been thinking about Presonio a little while. I've obviously known you guys for a little while, and really from afar though, and it just struck me that wow, this is like one of the HR tech businesses that has kind of like hit every milestone so far. You know, if you look at the progress of the company over the last 5 years, it's really been one of those incredible journeys where you see every year there's this like step change progress, you know, matched by the funding rounds. Obviously, investor confidence is there, customer growth is there, all of these types of things. I'm kind of thinking that, okay, Presonio is like this slalom skier going down a ski slope and they're hitting every gate. And I'm just thinking, at what point do you feel as if you're going to crash, or do you feel like this is it? Like you're going to hit the finish line. You're already like on course. How does it feel to be running a business that has hit all of these milestones seemingly without any huge backward step?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I think we have to acknowledge that, it would be kind of, not true to say there were all these hard challenges and we thought the business would fail 10 times along the way. We didn't think, as you said, it has developed well, and we've been very grateful for it. However, I do want to acknowledge that in order to do that, there was a lot of hard work involved, but also a lot of luck. And it's not that we were just much smarter than any other company that has more troubles. I think we were lucky on timing. I think the market has been very ready and has been evolving with us over time and even accelerated that trend. And COVID, quite frankly, while it was tough for many reasons for everyone in the industry, including ourselves, it has also accelerated that trend of digitization. So firstly, I think timing was key for us coming into that market and digitizing SMEs. However, I think beyond that, it's just been over time, to your question of do we feel we're going to crash. I think we've in fact gained more and more confidence over time, because in the beginning, of course, you always like, can we again double or triple next year? Is there enough market? Is that, and by the time when north of 3,000 companies using our product on a daily basis, engaging more and more with the product, being active in more and more markets, we gain more confidence that what we set out to do back in 2016, when we really kicked off of becoming the leading player and really developing this European market, is actually seemingly to become true. And that's what we're still working towards, of course. But yeah, I don't think we'll crash anytime soon.
you know, it is fantastic to see because, you know, you do hear tough stories about startup, right? You hear tough stories about people having to really grind hard. Not saying you guys haven't done that. And obviously the statistics will tell you that the majority of businesses never make it even close to where you guys are. So fantastic that you've gone to this degree. And it reminded me of something that I read the other day about how not only startups, but most initiatives are significantly about momentum. You know, it's almost like you just got to keep it rolling, and that will just create further opportunities for you. And the crisis point is actually when you stop, or you hit a block and you can't move forward. That becomes suddenly a huge effort to try and shift it further this way. Were you conscious of this idea of momentum, Hanno, or was it a case that, you know, it was more opportunistic rather than strategic?
So I think, everyone starting a company in any industry, I believe, which would think that this is the right time to do it. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it at that point in time. So clearly, we, of course, were feeling there's an opportunity there, and then we felt this is the right time to do it. But only until you really then see the market and developing your direction, or you even maybe having some impact on helping the market develop into that direction faster, you really kind of start feeling that momentum. And I think that's part two, what I mentioned before with the luck. I don't want to say it's strategic enough. I was able to foresee the future the same way how Daniel Ek from Spotify hasn't been able to back then understand that this was exactly the right time to find Spotify. But looking back, what everyone would be able to see that 5 years earlier, he wouldn't be able to pull up that business because record companies were still way too much in their own kind of old way of doing business. And 5 years later, he would have been too late. So he hit the right timing. And that's at a time, was he knowing that? Probably he hoped that is the case, the same way we did. But probably he also didn't know better than we did. So I think that we hope this is the right time to do it. We went after it at a time and worked hard to also help create that momentum. But in parts, we also were lucky that it held true.
Why did you go for the HR side of things, Hanno? I mean, obviously, there's all kinds of different opportunity when, you know, you think about society and companies digitizing. There could be any number of different types of services or products you could produce. Why did it appear obvious to you that actually it needed to be in the HR space? That was a great opportunity.
So I think, besides the opportunity is seeing that this is a part that's been highly underdeveloped, especially in the SME space. Larger enterprises had started to pick up Workday and SuccessFactors, but in the SME space, there was just no solution really tailored to those countries, companies, and hence this dedication for us was important. But I think beyond that, we just really from the beginning on were excited by the promise of helping companies with their most important success factor of the business. So people being so important for a business that the fact that this part is not digitized just seemed crazy to us. And therefore we felt helping them digitize and helping them manage their most important success factor of the business is really important. But also the fact that we then with that working very closely with our HR manager and users of the product, but also beyond that, having an impact on every single employee on the company through them using our product was something that motivated us.
Would you say the classic example of the first customer of Personio would be a company that is using multiple products for various different services? So they have one service for payroll, they'll have another thing for recruiting, they'll have maybe another thing to do benefits or something. Like it's basically a mix of different types of products. So normally this is when you're providing all in one solution. Is that how you see your customer base currently, Hanno?
In part. So this is one group of customers that looks to consolidate, and hence the reason we call ourselves the HR operating system is because we believe we can help create a system of record that both covers a vast part of the employee lifecycle, but also integrates well with tools around it. So to your point, a certain number of, or around a third of our customers that joined Personio come exactly from that a fragmented approach and looking to consolidate. Then we have around 40% of customers that really come from Excel, pen and paper and not use anything.
40%?
40%. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, it's partly the young companies that have their first solution, but also really it's established companies with 500, 600, 800 employees that still manage.
I've seen it, man. I've seen like people hit the Excel limit. I forget how many rows is possible to have, but these enormous bits of software.
It's like that was one of the insights we had back then, by the way, that Excel lists are great to calculate for calculations and all kinds of things, but they really fail when managing people data, not just because of the limit of the cells, but really because a lot of people have to operate, and I'm sure a lot of people here on the call know that in an organization have to have access to people data, but everyone has access in a different way. An employee can maybe update their own data, HR manager can see everything, a supervisor only their team. So all of this is not possible with an Excel sheet. That's where an Excel sheet fails, and that's where of course we try to do it much better. But that's the second group, and the remaining of the group is then coming from either maybe smaller less mature solutions that are looking to kind of get something more in depth, because the configurability and the depth of the product was important for us from the beginning. So that's something where people come from, or from more traditional on-premise solution, which just are not as modern, flexible user interface. So that's roughly, so it's a broad mix where people come from. We get them from all kind of angles and backgrounds, but that's the rough mix.
Yeah, amazing. You obviously started the company with a bunch of your colleagues. I believe university friends, Hanno, is that right? Like the founding group, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the first bunch of the first co-founding group? Like who is that, and how did you know those folks?
Yeah, so Roman and Lassini, two of my co-founders, I met here in Munich during university, and we started together. We're working together on projects. We were from different disciplinary backgrounds. So Roman, Lassini was a computer scientist. Roman was a software engineer, but a bit more on sort of was media informatics, I think, was the background he studied. I'm an industrial engineer, so I know stuff about mechanical engineering, which is not very helpful when building software. But we had very different backgrounds, and that was certainly helpful. We were brought together in a small entrepreneurial program here in Munich called CDTM, and that's also where we found our first then employee, Jonas, who is by now a chief operations officer, so still in the business. And that was sort of the early bunch of people kind of coming out of university. And none of us, as you can tell, had an HR background, but in a way that was, of course, a challenge, but in a way that also really established what we today call one of our core values, which is customer empathy, because we had to learn so much about the HR space. We had to go to talk to them. We had to go to spend time with them. And I think that really helped us create that constantly learning from customers, constantly getting better, constantly delivering a better solution for them. And that was important to us.
You know what? Everything you're saying just wants to lead me to another point in this chat, Hanno. Very, very interesting. Because a common criticism of HR tech, which I think is often an invalid criticism, but it's used anyway, is exactly to say, oh, these are just a bunch of engineers that don't know what HR world is. This is why they produce this piece of crap, quote unquote. So they associate bad experience with the idea that the builders don't know the job of HR. I think that's slightly unfair. There's certainly examples where that may be the case, but I don't think it's the direct relationship. What's happening here, Hanno? Is it? Do I need to put up the not safe for work flag at some point?
No. I stay like that, but the warmth's coming in.
I can see the sunshine flying through. That's all good. You just like made half the audience faint there, Hanno. But that's all okay. Part of the show. So you guys knew that there was an information gap, right? So you were coming from, okay, you wanted to service this this industry. Presumably you encountered some difficulties, I guess, interacting maybe with first jobs or whatnot. But you thought that, okay, how do we backfill this information gap in terms of, you know, the customers we're servicing? How do you get that empathy? Because is that a natural thing? Is that just like due to your character, or is there like a structure people can follow?
So maybe two things. First, on your point around the criticism for people that don't know HR. So I do think in parts it's fair, in parts it's unfair. I think it is important if you want to challenge the way things are and do something new, that it's good to have that outside perspective. But on the other hand, it also helps to have that insight. And we have hired loads of people since then, of course, with HR backgrounds, not just for our own people team, but also more broadly in customer service, in product experts, in product management, and other roles. So we, of course, trying to add that knowledge over time. However, to the second part of the question around how do you get that empathy, I think a lot has to do with sort of a sense of humbleness, of like, we don't know how this works. We have an idea, and clearly there's some things around HR where you can start at least with common sense, and as in, if someone requests a vacation, there's someone that needs to approve it, or if you might want to have that overview. So there's some things which you as a that you, I think, can figure out, but there's a lot of details and are a lot of kind of specifics that you can't figure out with common sense, and we couldn't either. So really that humbleness of not like, oh yeah, we'll get that done, and vacation management is easy, it's just 30 days and then they count down and we quickly build that, but really talking to the customer, what is your biggest problem with vacation management? And then learning that the end of the year accruals and taxation issue that comes with how many vacation days are open and how not is the actual issue. And that's what you need to also make sure your system is providing. And these kind of complexities is then where I think if you're humble enough to understand that you have no clue, essentially, then you get to come to these conversations with your customers.
That kind of curiosity is critical, isn't it? That's the thing that I think bridges that gap. For the critics that say, hey, this person isn't from HR or whatever, what bridges the gap is that natural curiosity about that job. Because they, as you say, it's all of the informal knowledge that is often not like captured in documentation, or it's not in any official kind of procedural documents. That's the stuff that really is the pain points often. What is happening actually, the subtext, not the not the stuff on the surface. Personio, you mentioned it's been around probably for 2016. So the product has been around now 4 or 5 years or so. Take it back to the first iteration, Hanno. When you first got it out there and you built it, I guess maybe the founding team, it sounds like you have engineering skills to probably knock something together. What was that product at that time? Do you remember? Like what did you have people looking at and using?
Yeah. Indeed, we were, and I think it was also important that we weren't just like a bunch of business people trying to then outsource the building, but we really were, I mean, product managers and engineers and customer service agents essentially for a really long time. And then I started at some point doing some sales and talking to customers. But the initial version was really what I explained earlier, that the Excel sheet that captures employee data, putting that into a software that can be accessed by everyone in the organization based on a very complex set of access rights, viewing rights, or edit rights, depending on who should participate where. And then, of course, displaying that in a structured format also on like personal tabs for on an individual basis, as opposed to just a big list which you can filter from. And I think that is sort of the initial basis. And then very quickly, from our first users and customers of the product, we then learned that, of course, like around that, if you have that data, we'd love to create contracts on the back of that. So we created an engine that can transfer from that data of an employee an automated contract or another file based on a template. We then extended towards vacation tracking and so on. At some point, moved into recruiting. So from there, it really sped out. But I think the really initial part was that codifying HR data.
I love it. I mean, basically, how do we get an Excel spreadsheet online with more sophisticated access permissions, basically? So a lot of software is just this. It's like taking what people have had to hack together because there hasn't been a solution. People have just repurposed technology in whatever way to make it work. But that is a potential opportunity for a disruptive service if you can make it smoother, better, and more efficient. So fascinating stuff. Let's stop in terms of where we're at now, Hanno, and kind of time shift our way back, back in the university days and stuff like that. You entered uni to do industrial engineering. Did you ever imagine, what was your path when you went into university, Hanno? Did you think of yourself to be, okay, this is the career, I want to be an industrial engineer now?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, I never came up with the idea of become an entrepreneur. My both parents are teachers, so it's just never been on the radar to start an own company. Probably if it wasn't for meeting my co-founder and coming up with an idea, probably would have ended up working in a solar company as an engineer, trying to help design solar panels. That's what I did in some internships.
Yep, amazing. But sometimes things happen in your circumstance. Again, this is about not everything is strategy, right? It's like sometimes it is about taking advantage of opportunity. And maybe successful entrepreneurship is a significant component of that, being sensitive to where the opportunity is and then understanding that you have to pursue it right there and then. I don't want to get overly political at all, Hanno, but why was it that you were the CEO? So you had a bunch of founders there. I'm sure they're equally intelligent, equally talented. What was the distribution of roles? Like, how did you decide, okay, you're going to do this, I'm going to do that?
Yeah. So funnily, and I think that's part of, because we're not, I mean, my study background was probably the most business heavy on all, like industrial engineering in Germany comprises out of some business elements and some management classes and some engineering classes, while the others were mainly computer science and software engineering backgrounds. But still, I think we never really had any fights around titles or is it important. It wasn't important for me to stick out as a CEO. It was really more of a what we kind of sketched on how do we collaborate, how can we help customers, and really the role of the CEO in the beginning, while I had that title, doesn't really exist. I mean, you're just doing whatever's necessary. I was customers, like, more focused on talking to customers and like kind of product managing, essentially trying to come up with problems learned from users and then feeding them to my co-founders who were coding the product, which I wasn't able to do. So that was more the natural part. And then I think from just also my things, I naturally tend to be better at it. It's like going to the outside, talking to investors and these kind of things. So a lot of that stuff evolved. And then eventually, as we started building up a team, my two co-founders also requested that we shape a structure in a way that I'm with moving out of, like, it was head of HR for a while, head of sales, or like this interim where you'd have several roles in the same time as you build out different teams. And then they at some point said, okay, if you're now pulling out and don't manage any of these teams directly, what we do, then you should also manage us. So it's that there's someone having a consistent overview. So it was almost an idea from their side also to make sure we have a cohesive structure that can scale and support a business.
Great stuff. Has your life changed in any way since you've been the CEO? I mean, I get it that, you know, it's not an ego thing, but sometimes it is a different sort of role because of the situation is you're the final executive. You know, whenever there is a tough decision, it's on you to make that decision. And, you know, you have a greater impact on what is now a significant business. Like, you've got hundreds of people working for you now. So what is the how has your life changed now that you're sort of in this role as a CEO for several years now, Hanno?
So I think, first of all, I always like to refer to people working with me and being colleagues rather than for me, because I think everyone has a role at Prisonio and I have one equally than anyone else. I think my role has significantly changed over the years, for sure. It would be weird to say anything different from being a three-people company to now 640. And of course, throughout the time, it constantly has changed. And for a really long time, you have the title of a CEO, but you're essentially doing team lead roles or IC roles or whatever. And eventually, it really shifts more into this, now it makes sense that I build an executive team, that I think about strategy, that I raise money, and all the other things that come over time. I've just really enjoyed that change, to be honest. It didn't really affect me personally in any good or bad way. I just really enjoyed the ride, enjoyed this constant changing. I sometimes refer to it as being thrown in cold water, and then the water just never gets warm because it's constantly, I don't know, like a pipe of cold water being added. And that's the growth of the business, and that's what I enjoy.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that kind of goes with the metaphor we used earlier about the ski slope, right? Like, you're constantly moving forward and hitting the gates. It's always a new situation. You're not sort of treading water, I guess, is the right term. You're not staying still. What have you learned as a CEO? Is there any principles that you've kind of distilled that has caused you to think, you know what, that's actually pretty much universal advice. If you could advise a young person who is in your shoes, coming up and thinking about setting up a business, what universal things that can you say, look, this is definitely probably the case as a CEO, this is what you should know?
So I start from very universal, which might almost to be too obvious to call out. But I think what helped us and myself for being a first time, not even just first time entrepreneur, but first time employee or worker in a company out of university, was that we didn't know anything. And we didn't, I've done a couple of internships and worked as a skipper, but I've never really been in a company for longer. And therefore, you don't know how things are supposed to work. And therefore, you take all these, or at least I decided to take all these principles that you can read in books very, very much like literal. So if you, for example, someone says, well, people are the single most important aspect of any business, then you really realize, oh, wow, if that's that important, then we should be really, really strict in recruiting. We should really, really find the best people. And that's, everyone says that, but I think not a lot of businesses actually do that. So it's very simple, if you're that naive, as we were, to just say, okay, then we really have to double down. And that led us to now nowadays having 40,000 applicants a year and hiring only 300 of them, because we realized, oh, this is so important. We have to get the best people. And I think that, like, that's just kind of been this taking advice very literal and then really doing very diligent on applying that.
That is not an obvious angle at all, Anno, and I think it's a marvelous way of looking at it. So you're basically saying you were so naive as a business professional, because it was more or less the first thing you guys did, that you simply said, look, here are what other people are saying are important principles. We're not in a position to challenge that, and probably we don't have the time. We're just going to have to take these ideas and just call them axioms and roll with it. So there's an advantage. I mean, there's a lot of discussion right now in the recruiting world about, you know, what is the important thing? Do you recruit for knowledge, or do you recruit for skills? Do you recruit for attitude? Do you recruit for this, that, and the other? Now, historically, recruitment's always been recruiting for knowledge. You hire for someone who's done the job before, typically. But this actually, the founding team here might actually be an example of why, you know, you don't need to do that, because if you have the right attitude and the right competencies, then actually you can create something really great without necessarily having that prior experience. And in fact, sometimes prior experience, if you've learned the wrong lessons, that can be like a negative, right? Coming in, bringing those types of things. Let's move on just a year or two after for the evolution of this, Hanno. I think for a startup, the big recruitment crisis comes when you run out of friends, right? So the first group of people, you already have the trust relationship. Of course, you're going to try and bring them in. But at some point, you simply have run out of the referrals, right? There's no more people in your network that you can bring in. And you have to think, okay, this is the first important hire I'm going to make, that none of us know this person. How do we make sure that's the right person to get in? How did you guys do that?
Yeah, we fairly early, and I think there's this misconception around startups are being successful because of creative chaos and everyone like this, and process is sort of like a bad word in that industry. And I would feel that's a misconception. You need to be like agile, whatever agile means, but you need to be flexible and then fast moving and adapting and constantly improving. But I don't think you should not have processes. So we fairly early on implemented a very consistent recruiting process, which we kept evolving over time, but which really made sure that we have multiple people in the organization figuring out with a clear task on this is what you'll be checking in that interview. And we would really want you to not just be all right, like whatever, but really caring about, is this the right person? And if both in the initial phases with the recruiters, but also the hiring manager, the team lead, but also then in ongoing phases where we bring in people from the organization that have no interaction or will have no direct interaction with that colleague and have no bias towards, oh, we really need to fill that role, to figure out, is this a person that fits with our operating principles? And then vetoing a hire if that's not the case. So these are, I think, where we fairly early on as we started hiring, and we didn't have a ton of candidates at the time, so it was really painful to go through the five people we had applying and then potentially hire none of them and then have to keep going out and search again for roles for sometimes months. But I think that that persistence on keeping ourselves honest to what I said before, you shouldn't hire when you're in doubt, so probably then not do that, but also putting a process in place where multiple people that don't have the urgency bias of really needing that role be included in the process and challenge whether this is really the right candidate.
Yeah, I love that idea of bringing in people from like that are not so proximate to the function to be involved in the recruiting, because they actually can come in probably with a greater objective view than someone who, you know, wants to offload a bit of work. Let's say everyone's like hugely under stress, obviously you're desperate for the extra hands on deck, so to speak, and you know, you might end up compromising a lot of your principles if that's your focus. But bringing in like external people, not external people, but people who are not so close to the role itself, to analyze on principles, that I think is actually quite a sophisticated way of thinking about recruitment, Hanno. As a completely naive founder, like how did you come up with that idea? Was that also something you read in a book?
It was a combination. I think we always, I think the other piece, like why we really trusted in these basic principles, like people being super important, like constantly to trust, like be really not hire if you're in doubt and all of these things, we took very literal. For other things, we read about things, we talked to others, but then we always, with common sense, try to, how can we, or in our learnings, try to evolve them better. So with, for example, talking about OKRs, most of people have heard of it, but it's a goal framework, objectives and key results, how you can organize the company. And we implemented that in 2016, where we were around 5 to 6 people for the first time. Someone explained us the concept. We then took that for literal, implemented it. But then, and I think there's no, that you can read the book from Intel, how they first did it. There's one from Google and so on. But essentially, you have to then take that knowledge, take it as a starting point, and from there evolve. And we, since every quarter, and we've been by now in quarter 26 or whatever, when we're doing OKRs, and we've constantly evolved on, this has been a problem. We have been setting too much input-driven goals, so let's next quarter only go on output-driven goals. At some point realizing, we've gone too far that way. So like we constantly made our way to improving. We've implemented OKR first, and we figured, how can we make them more inclusive? So we constantly took a concept and improved it. And I think that's where, again, both a bit of the naivety where you take that, but then also this curiosity and a drive to make things better has helped us.
When was the time that you brought in someone to manage the hiring aspect of it, Hanno? Because there was a point, I guess, where the founders were doing that. Then maybe some managers were doing some recruiting. But at some point, maybe there was a person you brought in to oversee this and to take on things like managing the OKRs. When was that moment in the journey, Hanno?
So the OKRs, we still... Jonas, our chief operations officer, is sort of the core exec owner of that. But generally, OKRs are something we've established, OKR champions for each department, and something which we manage across the business. When it comes to recruiting, we were around 15 when we hired the first HR manager recruiter as a full-time person. Before, mm-hmm. I was a working student. And Martina, our now director talent, who is responsible for recruiting, we hired when we were 40 or 50 maybe. But really, that doesn't mean recruiting now is off the founder's table. Still today, we have a founder interview for every full-time person that we bring on board. So I have somewhere between 10 and 15 interviews, just of these founder interviews, every week. And that's therefore we didn't delegate the hiring. We just hired people, and we have a large recruiting function helping us find the right people and managing it through the process.
That's great. I was about to mention this next comment, like what is the input that the founding team has now? Because as you mentioned, you're up to 600 plus, I think you're opening up a big center in Dublin, I think, a couple more hundred people there. Presume you got a huge raise, right? We're going to talk about that in a second. Presumably that's going to be spent on increasing the numbers of people. But you're still saying that everybody who goes through the process still has a founder interview. So either you or one of the other founders that are there has the final interview with them. Why do you do that? And how long do you think you're going to persist with that approach?
So why is exactly for that ultimate sense check for, are we hiring for urgency or are we hiring because we're certain? So just to include that into the process, and like, it's not because we have a better sense of who's a great candidate or not. I mean, yes, I've probably interviewed a few thousand people by now, or certainly several thousand. So I probably have a bit of pattern recognition who fits our culture and who doesn't. But a lot of the others interview a ton of people as well, and everyone has, I think, a good sense. But really, I think there's no one that's less kind of, I mean, we all want the business to grow, but that's less directly to a specific role tied to that we need to hire that person today rather than 2 weeks or in a month or in 3 months. And then I think we found this, and we try to build in what we call bar racers, so individuals from across the business that have been long with the business, that have been proven great culture fits to replace us over time. And we're having them run in parallel to compare data and see how well the overlap is between them and whether they have the same level of strictness. But that's what we'll hopefully at some point help replace for some roles. I'm sure we will continue forever hiring 10, 15 people a week, but probably then some roles, more junior roles, will fade out over time. However, what's important to call out is that I have an important role in the hiring process, but not more important than others. So there's roles where I, in the final phase of the last two interviews, the last three interviews, I give a go for someone and then someone else vetoes, and that person then doesn't get hired. So it's not on me to say, oh yeah, yes or no, but it's, of course, I veto people, but I also don't have the final say or decide over others if they don't think it's the right fit.
Yep, fantastic. A couple of concepts there. I think people need to kind of be aware of them if you're watching along. The idea of bar raising, I think a lot of really innovative and fast-growing businesses have this concept. So it is the idea of bringing in, again, the external or so people who are a little bit more distant from the role or the function in that department, and their job is basically to understand, to have that measure. Is this person going to come in and improve the business overall in terms of the values, the skills, the contribution? And if you like, defeat this other concept that we need to be aware of, urgency bias, because recruiting too often, almost inevitably perhaps, is almost, I wouldn't say panic, but it's like, we need this now, right? No one ever said, yeah, we can hire this person 6 weeks, no problem. No one ever has that, right? It's like constantly, we need it yesterday. So that is great because it gives you the focus, but it's also negative because it means you might be reaching and making excuses for hiring someone when the fit isn't correct for whatever reason it might be. Okay, cool. Let's talk about these huge raises that you've been made, Hanno. So, you know, was it 75 million just 12 months ago? And I thought, okay, that's fantastic. See what these guys are going to do with that. And then, you know, I come into 2021. It's like Andrea calls me and says, yeah, we just raised 225. Okay, so with all of that money, what are you going to do with it? What's the plan?
So, I mean, first of all, we still have the majority from last round left, so it was less about we've spent all of this money already and we need more, but it was more of there's so much demand from existing investors to provide us with more capital at very good terms, and we really like to be able to focus on our customers, to be able to continue to not be distracted with outside opinions or having to fundraise. So therefore, the opportunity to just having that money in the bank account gives us, of course, the time and focus to just execute on our strategy and focus on our customers. However, we, of course, will spend the money over time, and that the areas we invest is primarily the product. We have around 220 people working in the product and engineering organization today. That's a little bit over a third of the entire business. And that function is going to double over the course of the next 12 months. So that's a really important one to make sure that we continue to invest in the product. There's a lot of things that Personio can do today already at the product, but there's so many things and good feedback from our customers where we can continuously improve. So doubling down there is the key. equally when it comes to the second largest function of our business, which is our customer success organization, which we're also investing heavily to provide the best support to our customers to help them onboard to get the biggest value out of the product and work closely with them. That's another big area of investment. And then I think the third one is for us expanding. You mentioned our Dublin office. We have another office in London and Madrid that are fastly growing. And I think a lot of these offices and these expansions into these markets, it's not just the offices, but also we've entered Spain and France recently, where we're growing our customer base rapidly. And all of these, of course, require a lot of investment, both on the product side, but also on the go-to-market side.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, this leads us quite nicely onto this customer demand. So you've got like 3,000 customers, fantastic. People are using Personio, but I think that's a big enough data set for them, for you to start understanding, okay, what is the market telling us in terms of the product roadmap? Like, how do we prioritize the feature set? What do we push out to this group? What have they told you? Like, what's the demand from this group of businesses that you've been dealing with?
So it's of course a very broad demand because different companies have different requirements. So there's a certain bucket which we just call customer must-haves. So feature requests that we hear a lot. For example, things like multi-brand career pages for companies that are maybe a couple hundred employee and have certain sub-brands which you want to recruit through, which is something which we're just about to launch. And so those are what in the bucket of customer must-have. Then we have the bucket of course, the local needs for these customers. So we're investing heavily, as mentioned, in the European areas and for some countries, such as Italy, where hourly absences is a big area. So tracking vacation days, not just in days, but in hours. So that's something which we're currently in the final steps of launching. There's a lot of demand for payroll integrations, which we're heavily working on to aggregate data and send them over to payroll providers. And then more broadly, there's a big effort from our side, which also matches the demand and request of customers to be able to integrate Personio with multiple tools and to run workflows holistically across these tools. So therefore, we're launching integration with Slack, where you will be able to request your vacation through that and approve it. Same with Microsoft Teams and many of these other integrations of tools that are around Personio.
Yeah, and all of these tools obviously have become, you know, had this kind of immediate shock adoption over the last 12 months, haven't they? Where at one point probably they were fairly peripheral products, but now obviously they're the default. So suddenly market opportunity opens up and that you need to grab. With regards to COVID-19 and this shift to distributed working, I have a theory that obviously this is going to change how sort of businesses look. How are they even organized? How are they actually structured internally? The kinds of worker that they need. Has the shift to remote sort of changed your vision of the product roadmap in any way, Hanno? What do you think has happened in your own thought process as to, you know, let's say COVID-19 didn't happen, you were going down this route, COVID-19 has happened, what changes has occurred?
Yeah, I think even more things, and that's displayed a lot along existing features, but also new features which we've done, of course, have to happen with people not being able to be in the same space, same office. So while there's a lot of things like application requests or onboarding process, recruiting process, where we already had that notion of we can do that collectively without being together in office, we've launched stuff like e-signatures, where we have an embedded functionality to send out contracts to candidates and to other people to sign, also to existing employees. So all of that, having that run digitally in the system without having to leave and then drop it back in and so on and send around stuff postally. So that's been a big one. When it comes to our absence management functionalities, we've been more and more seeing demands and usage for home office tracking or even remote tracking, because a lot of companies, as ourselves also, are shifting to hybrid ways. And then you do want to know, is someone today in the office? Is sometimes someone today like in home office? Or are they maybe even working from Madeira because they've done the vacation there and we're extending it by a week? And these kind of functionalities also both to in parts approve that some people, especially for longer stays away, companies need want to have this being approved. But secondly, also that visibility. For example, our Slack integrations automatically updates your status that someone is on vacation and comes back in 2 weeks. So if you send someone a message, you directly see, okay, this person is probably not going to respond. I think these little things have become more and more important and have adapted the way we build the product.
It is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, obviously, this period has been a tragic period for the planet, but I can't help but be like academically interested in what's going to happen, because we can see and actually live in sort of the this period of change. You just mentioned the idea of holidays, for instance. Back in the day, a holiday would obviously mean absent from the office. But what does even a holiday mean when everyone is always absent from the office, but they may actually still be physically in the same place, but they're actually on holiday? So, you know, what do we do as a business that you should obviously leave this person alone, even though the temptation is to say, look, I can see you on whatever thing you're at. So big cultural change, which I think will then cascade into product change as well. So super exciting on how we see there. Let's have a think about sort of, we talked about a roadmap. We've talked about the team and the culture. Without disclosing anything that's kind of too confidential, Hanno, what is the sort of the aim in terms of the European market? Obviously, the German-speaking market was the predominant space that Personio wanted to be at. I think this year become the first European company that has hit like unicorn status, I think, from HR Tech, which is a fantastic accolade. And now you're saying you're entering France, Spain, UK, all those types of places, all of them with different like HR requirements, actually different jurisdictions. Like that seems to be like a massive, one of the biggest problems, right? Dealing with these local issues. What's your strategy in building products suitable for these different territories?
Yeah. So first of all, as you mentioned, we're very much committed towards the European market, and we're very much committed towards SMEs, so companies between 10 and 2,000 employees in that market. And there's 1.7 million companies in Europe between 10 and 2,000 employees, and we're currently serving, as you mentioned, a little bit over 3,000. So there's a long way for us to go, and we really want to double down on that segment. We don't have any intention of moving to the enterprise. When it comes to the different markets, we are indeed, of course, started with our German business, because we didn't want to dilute focus too early, but we already on knew that we want to build a European company, and hence we built a product in a fairly flexible way already. And even today, we have already companies using the product in 80 different countries around the world, which still means we're focused to Europe. But a lot of European companies, whether they're based in Germany, France, and so on, have, of course, subsidiaries around the world. So we, even way before we started entering these new markets, were exposed to the German company that has a Spanish, a French, and a UK office. And therefore, we were exposed to a lot of these adaptations already, and some we made at the time, including a lot of adding a lot of languages and so on, and some we only are now tackling. But we, I think the our product, if you look at the entire employee lifecycle, which we are digitalizing and covering, there's areas like recruiting, which are fairly country in-specific, apart from maybe the job boards you want to advertise on. And then there's areas such as the absence management and time tracking, which are super country specific, where we're having to invest a lot more. So that's where I think how we think about it generally. So very much committed to building the best product in that space for European SMEs, but equally, of course, understanding that there's areas that are very that don't require a lot of change, and areas where we already today had invested and will invest further to be the best product for those companies.
What's the situation with companies that are hiring like from anywhere? So one of the really interesting challenges that we're starting to see like serious problems with actually is, okay, this company has decided we're remote, now we're remote anywhere. That's amazing. And they're stumbling onto payroll issues, taxation issues, all these types of things. Oh, we've just hired this fellow from Hungary, let's say, and we literally have no idea how to provide all of these basic stuff to them. Is this something that you're trying to build a service around, or do you think the payroll provider will do that and you just need to interface with a partner?
So there's certain elements around payroll which we will do ourselves, but we're certainly not going to optimize for, because if you go that route, you want to be the one global person that can also hire someone not only in Hungary but also in Southeast Asia or Central America or else countries around the world. And therefore, we have a lot of partners that build actually on Personio. So one partner is WorkMotion is building, in fact, on top of Personio exactly these capabilities, because they know that's already where the system of record lies. That's where the core data of all employees sits. And then there's some that from Personio directly go to the tax advisor or the payroll company into certain countries. And for these remote people, they get funneled through WorkMotion. And hence, that helps exactly with all these taxation issues. And we ourselves have hired a few people in places where we didn't have permanent establishment yet through that company.
Yeah, very, very interesting. It's a super interesting challenge. I look forward to seeing sort of those global solutions. It's going to be, again, another fascinating space to explore. A question I forgot to answer about the customer purchasing side. What is the? But I think it's relevant. I'm going to ask every founder this because I'm sure it's one of the most frustrating things for a vendor. What is the most a common mistake you see a customer make when they buy Personio? Like an implementation error, or like what causes them not to succeed? Most common thing.
So I think once you've bought Personio, I would pride ourselves with a very strong and structured implementation process and a very strong and capable implementation team that really supports customers along that stage. So there's also documentation around that on our website and our help center. But really, once you've signed, you get your implementation manager that guides you through the process. And I think the only thing we can't control, of course, is the data you provide us for entering into the system, for uploading into the system. But that even there, we help with the quality checks. But that's therefore, I think there's very little risk. I think what sometimes gets a bit an issue in a buying process for companies not indexing enough about the depth of features, exactly what we touched on a little bit earlier, where we might compete with a very lightweight solution and that's a lot cheaper to Personio, and then people feel like, oh, on the top level, that's the same functionality as Personio's. They also have an absence management. They also have a reporting engine, but then we have a very detailed custom reporting, which you need to really succeed in that space. And we have some of the functionalities around absence I alluded to before. And I think sometimes it's this underestimating what you really need to succeed and not just checking off a list and really going deep. And I advise everyone talking to also Personio salesperson to challenge them hard to really get what they need to cover their needs. But hopefully we're able to cover them and give the right level of service then.
Yeah, I think it's a collaborative thing, isn't it? No solution is going to be there completely just out of the box, switch it on and it works in without sort of big commitment from both the supplier and the buyer. And utilization is a change management issue, right? You've got to get people to embrace the idea of using this new tool new services, should we say. And it isn't just the case that product doesn't work. It really is the tool and the tool maker together. Okay, great. Let's move on to the wider scope, Hanno. This kind of steps us away a little bit from Personio. But there's all kinds of interesting things happening in the world, and I'm always wanting to speak to people that might have a perspective on it. What do you think is going to be the long-term impact of the pandemic for the society at large and specifically for business?
So I think it's hard to tell, of course, but it's driven opinion, but it's more and more a personal opinion. So I think one thing that will change in terms of how people do business is the amount of travel for business will go back. I do think that coming back to the office will happen. So from all the service we have and from what we hear, at least from our people, they demand more flexibility. They will receive more flexibility, but they also want to spend time in the office. And in fact, where I'm standing right now, this is where we're currently rebuilding or adding a new floor on top of our office. So this is a brand new space that has never been people working in, but people are eager to come back to spend time in the office to meet their colleagues again. I think that will return. I think business travel will also happen for the same reasons when it's about bringing people from different offices together to make sure they socialize and build connections, but by far not as much as it used to be in the past, where our investors would fly in from all around the world, from Silicon Valley to come to a board meeting once a quarter. I think that's just also ecologically not the right thing to do, and I don't think that will return as much, like for quick meetings flying around the globe or even Europe. But I think to an extent, really spending time with people will return. And I think for personal life, it'll be hard to tell. I think there's certain elements that make me wonder whether there's so much grieving now that people want to go out, travel again more, want to go out to parties and events and so on. But then there's also this element where a lot of people that might like be just, you know, used to this or a bit more cautious with large person gatherings. So I think it will be a very, in my personal opinion, I'm not a social scientist, but my personal opinion will be people will diverge very much from how they react going back. Some really kind of over-index on things they've done before and can do again, and some rather feel like, oh, I've actually learned to enjoy being by myself more, or going more hiking in the mountains as opposed to flying to Southeast Asia for a vacation.
I love that vision, man. It's like the time machine, isn't it, with the Eloy and the Morlocks. We're gonna get a bunch of people that are just hedonists, totally hit the bars. Let's get to it. I think definitely there's going to be that segment. But then there'll be other people that are kind of like, okay, they've got used to it. They've habituated themselves to live very different lifestyle, like a slower pace, less people, maybe a little bit more online, or maybe completely offline. You know, as you say, you're right on the mountains there. So you would probably, you're culturally, I think, in South Germany, in Bavaria, people are very active in the wild there. So basically, you might see two different groups of people emerge. So fascinating how that will kick off. Okay, a couple more of these big picture questions. What about Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos? Who's your preferred CEO type figure, Hanno, and why?
Not sure deciding between the two. So I really like the what I think both should do different is, instead of investing into Blue Origin or SpaceX, spend more their money more on investing into problems we have on the planet. So I think that's why I would critic on both of them. However, I think Elon Musk clearly has helped push the electrification of vehicles, and hence push all the oftentimes German car makers that have been behind on that. So I think he's been having a big impact there. Jeff Bezos, you can challenge his social standards across how he treats employees across the business. But of course, he's been an impressive entrepreneur with the amount of new areas, including AWS, Alexa, and other areas he's been kind of leapfrogged. So certain things to learn from both of them, but also things to critique, I guess.
Yeah, really sober view. How about UBI? A universal basic income, good idea or not, Hanno?
It's a good question. So I'm just reading a book currently, which is called The Tyranny of Merit, where it's about kind of how our society in a meritocratic way is kind of affirming everyone that's successful as like, oh, that's been their own work and that's been all their own achievement. And everyone that's unsuccessful is just their own fault. And I don't believe in that. I believe that people, although I didn't come from a rich family or anything, but still I had the opportunity to get a good education and so on. So I was certainly set up more for success than some other people are. And I think I'm not sure whether UBI is the right solution for that. But I do believe that finding ways to make sure that our economic scale is not constantly diverting, and people at the top benefiting more and more from gains at the stock market and so on, while others are having challenges. So maybe UBI is a solution to that, but maybe there's other ways to make sure to close that gap and increase more fairness.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, Hanno, I could speak to you for a long time. We've got loads of, it's been really fascinating getting your insight on the journey that you're on and still on, you know. I know you like love sailing, and we haven't even talked about, you know, that aspect of your life. But I guess in some respects, Personio is like one of these like super yachts that you're piloting out into the blue ocean. So let me wish you all the best with that. Before I let you go, though, Hanno, what is on the agenda for you the rest of the day? I know it's the end of the day for you now, but probably the stuff for you to do, like CEO stuff. What CEO stuff are you going to do after this after this session?
There's more work to do for sure today. I think there's a few more calls and one more interview on the agenda. If I flip back over here, one reference call from one of our investors for an investment they want to make, and then I have a development feedback session with my chief operations officer Jonas, and followed by a dinner. So that's what we're wrapping up with.
We now know that you schedule dinner into the calendar, Hanno. This is the life of the CEO. You have to put it in there. Okay, make sure you eat. Hanno Renner, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. It's been great to know you better. I think the people watching and using Personio or possibly thinking about it will really appreciate the time you shared here, because it's important to know the leadership group behind the product and the service. Hanno Renner, thank you very much for joining us on Founders Focus.
So much. Thank you very much, Hume. It was a pleasure. And thanks, everyone, for watching.
Great. That's about it, folks. Wasn't he a nice guy? And Bavaria and Munich, amazing places to visit. When this pandemic is over, I would highly recommend you give it a shot. And I don't just mean the Oktoberfest. There's lots more going on in Munich and in that part of the world than drinking the great beer. Okay, that's about it. Episode 2 of Founders Focus. I hope you've enjoyed it. Personio, by the way, are a rocket ship, $1 billion valuation, first HR tech business in Europe to achieve that accolade. They are the HR operating system for your small and medium-sized business. So if you're still wrestling with Excel spreadsheets, 1 million rows, as Michael said, and you need something better, check out Personio, 14-day free trial. Okay, we'll be back. We'll be back in Brainfuel Live tomorrow with an amazing show and more Founders Focuses coming up. We've got a list of CEOs queuing up to do this. So it's going to be a really interesting. I hope you're enjoying these types of personal and biographical views where we get up close and personal. Okay, follow the channel if you're interested in updates on that. Otherwise, I will see you next time.